Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Learning and changing are about turning information into knowledge. We may know something is good for us, but until we feel that it's good, it's hard to embrace. People come to see me and say, "I know what to do, why don't I do it?" Well, it turns out that learning is physical. It involves our physical brain and its complex structures, our emotions and feelings, and the entirety of our experience. Learning is emotional. You're not going to listen to this hour of content unless something in this introduction touches you personally. You might only remember something that's very personal to you, so you might decide that the show is about learning, or you might remember that it's about stress. Whatever you remember will only change the way you understand why you do what you do if it succeeds in touching you and igniting cascades of synapses that forms a new experience. It's how you integrate information and make it your own. Interested? Stay tuned as we explore the learning brain. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Lena. The Obama administration is working on what it calls sweeping change in the No Child Left Behind law inherited from the Bush administration. The reforms seem to center on changing the incentive system and standards for school and student performance. Although tests in math and reading are still at the core of the law's implementation, the goal has shifted from being narrowly focused on proficiency in reading and math as measured by standardized tests to include something referred to as being college ready. When my oldest daughter, Laurel, started school almost 35 years ago, a pleasant woman asked her what she was learning. Laurel, without much hesitation, said she was learning how to stand in line and how to take tests. Little seems to have changed, and for good reason. The education system then and now has the goal of training productive citizens, meaning employable and well-behaved. If health is the capacity to have a full, rich life, as we discuss in our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, then learning has to be at the core of that capacity. But just as healthcare institutions are really not about health, but about medical diagnosis and treatment, the institutions of education are not really about learning, but about training children for the worlds of work and civic responsibility. This shouldn't be news to anyone. The New York Times article that described the Obama administration's bold moves was filled with the views of administration officials, congressional Democrats and Republicans, union representatives for teachers. They weren't happy because teachers are handed all the responsibility for making the new plan work while receiving none of the powers they need to actually make it work, and a representative of the Business Roundtable, quite thrilled about the focus on increasing the quality of future employees. In other words, these dramatic changes are about politics and supplying the labor market. There was no discussion of how social inequity affects educational outcomes. There was no discussion of the actual college prospects for freshly minted college-ready high school graduates. Nor was there a discussion of the actual labor market that the resulting surplus of freshly minted college graduates will encounter. And even if they were taken into account, having a full, rich life consists of far more than preparation for a fulfilling job at a living wage, to the extent that such things exist, and to the extent that a child's access to them is affected by race, ethnicity, social class, income, gender, and sexual orientation. In fairness, neither social inequity nor conditions in the labor market are the responsibility of education institutions. It's not their job. Besides, many children have plenty of direct experience in these matters outside the classroom from which to learn. Science was also missing from the Times article. No discussion of whether this mode of education is actually productive. For example, one of the perverse effects of the old bad No Child Left Behind was the obsessive focus on reading and math scores to the detriment and defunding of other areas, music, the fine arts, and the humanities. The new improved No Child Left Behind promises to accommodate these other areas while still focusing on reading and math for performance standards. Consider music lessons in school. It is persistently underfunded or not funded at all through the regular school budget. Now consider the sizable body of research that demonstrates better cognitive development and spatial reasoning among children who regularly play a musical instrument. So, why doesn't No Child Left Behind fund music classes as a core part of the curriculum? Is it because music isn't a core skill like reading and math? Is it because music doesn't obviously develop core skills such as standing in line and taking tests? On the contrary, it encourages harmony, literally and figuratively. Certainly not suitable preparation for competition in college and the labor market. It doesn't make students college ready, it doesn't make them job ready, it doesn't add to their productivity as citizens. It does, however, enrich their lives and enhance their capacity for doing so. Doesn't this remind you a little too much of the healthcare system? What happens when you go to a doctor's office or hospital? You stand in line and take tests. You are being made diagnosis and treatment ready, since your job as a patient is to be diagnosed and treated. As I've said before, the purpose of an institution is social stability, no matter what its actual area of concern, whether it's the education of the young or the care and sick of the sick and infirm. I hasten to say that social stability is extremely important, but it's not what we live for. That would be something like music. The gift that is the capacity to learn, that is an essential capacity for health and for the power to have a full, rich life, is that the capacity to learn enables us to know, among many other things, when social stability for its own sake is good for us and when it's not, and what to do instead. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our new book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, which has its own Facebook page of the same name, if you wish to go there. Now to our topic for today, which is the learning brain, and our guest, author of The Art of Changing the Brain, James Zull, Z as in zebra, U-L-L, is professor of biology and director of the University Center for Innovation in Teaching and Education at Case Western Reserve University. His book is The Art of Changing the Brain, Enriching the Practice of Teaching by Exploring the Biology of Learning. With 25,000 in print, this is one of the most cited books in the higher education literature. And we're very excited to be speaking with you, James Zull. We were just talking about why Jeffrey was so touched by the book and why he wanted me to read it. I sent you an email last night. I was unable to put the book down even for a second. I had to read every sentence.
That's really nice. Thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. So you begin this book with an epiphany, a very powerful epiphany that really turns you around in terms of how you understand learning. Can you explain that to us, what your epiphany was? Do you want me to give you a hint?
Give me a hint.
Learning is physical?
Okay. Yeah, I first heard that phrase when I was giving a lecture at another university, and that teacher... one of the teachers told me that their students can't believe that learning is a physical process. And for some reason, I had never really thought of it. I guess I just assumed it so much that I didn't see it as anything unusual or particularly enlightening. But later on, as I was thinking about it, it just turned out, when I was trying to write the early chapters of the book, thinking what would get someone's attention, I thought, well, there's something that a good way to start the book, and perhaps the audience that I'm hoping to reach will read the second sentence if I start with that one first.
Well, what strikes me about it is that, you know, there have been other, you cite other authors in the book. You talk about, you sometimes mention Antonio Damasio, who writes, of course, Descartes' Error and the Feeling of What Happens, about the integration of the mind and the body, the fact that these two things are not separate, that the mind, the brain, is a physical thing. And one of the things that's lovely about the way you talk about learning is the way you talk about how learning becomes embodied, how it has to become a physical experience. You have to actually be, as you say, moved by something in order to let it in. And so so one of the things that we're talking about here, I think, is turning information into knowledge, taking information, which is just facts, and turning it into knowledge, and how that helps us to form a long-term memory instead of just memorizing something for a short period of time.
Yes. It's like you have to think of your brain like you think of your heart in a way that is, it's a physical organ in the body, and it is part of your survival machinery, which has evolved through natural selection over probably 4 million years or so. And the notion that your brain doesn't learn over in a can in the corner somewhere all by itself. It's just part of what you folks call the ecological the ecology of the individual or the ecology of a person. And that whole view, I think, is very helpful. It I don't know why you start using different metaphors in a way when you start thinking of it in that term. It's very natural to think, well, maybe you're smart if your brain is bigger, or if you have a certain diet or whatever it is, and to some extent all of that fits together in the learning organ. So that context, I guess that's a context, isn't it? It sort of is a way to surround your what you might have thought was something hardly physical at all, maybe not, and maybe something mystical or unexplainable, as part of what you have evolved to become as part of the human race, keeping that perspective, it makes you think differently.
Well, your book definitely made me think differently, and it struck me as I was reading it that you are explaining, primarily this book is intended, I know that you have a new book coming out, and I'm very happy to hear that, and I'm looking forward to reading it very much, for lay people. But this book that we're talking about, The Art of Changing the Brain, was written for teachers and instructors to help them learn about learning, because teachers are getting very frustrated because they're trying to pour all this valuable information into the heads of students, and it just doesn't work. And you noticed that the problem is that teaching and learning is about the person who is learning, not about the teacher who's performing in the front of the class. So in the same way, when I work with a client and they say, well, this is what I said in the beginning of the show, I have the right information, how come I can't act on it? So the challenge is to take the information and to make it so that it's possible for the person to incorporate it. And it strikes me that when you wrote this book, you had that challenge. So how did you approach it in terms of writing the book?
What a question.
Okay, well, we don't have to go there, but I'd like you to talk about this issue of how, I mean, you talk about all the ways that the brain works in terms of in the circle, you know, the way it goes in and it makes like a circle. Everything has loops and you have synapses firing and you have all these things happening. But you also have these wonderful stories in the book about actual teaching experiences with students where you understood what they were doing a certain way, and then you began it began to change, that things shifted. How do you get someone, whether it's your partner and you're having an argument, or you love somebody and you're trying to give them information, or a student, or in my practice or Jeffrey's practice when we're talking to people about their health, how do you make it relevant to people?
Right.
Talk about how you do that and how you did it in your book.
I think that what I tend to call what you're speaking of is ownership.
Mm-hmm.
When you do more than have it in a filing cabinet, it's part of your life, and you own what you know. And the way you come to own it is by being able to connect it with what you have experienced and what you have learned that is already meaningful to you. When I'm writing a lot, some of my neuroscience friends keep reminding me that the brain is not a row of measuring cups into which you pour certain amounts of something and keep it, but that it's a dynamic entity where everything, or most things at least, are connected to each other. And I'm sure you've experienced this, Lena, where someone was able to explain something to you when they could relate it to something they knew about you, some experience mm-hmm. you had, or something that fit in the particular time and moment when you were experiencing some new things. So, for example, Chapter 6 focuses on the idea of what we already know as the best tool a teacher can have to understand what the learners already know. And it's remarkable because the physical model of learning is just like that. It's attaching neurons through synapses to what's already there.
Mm-hmm.
And growing more and more complex networks rather than containers. So everything at some point is connected to everything else. But at the same time, it's a changing network. It's not like a tree or something, which you could think of as a network with branches, and the branches have branches. But it's a dynamic network. It's a biological thing, constantly growing and changing and responding to what is around it.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett, PhD, is here. We're on the phone with James E. Zull. It's spelled Z as in zebra, U-L-L. His book is The Art of Changing the Brain, Enriching the Practice of Teaching by Exploring the Biology of Learning. And we're talking about how people learn. Again, this concept that learning or understanding has to do with what we already know, so that things have to resonate. There was many years ago, when I was quite young, I was working in advertising, and there was an ad copy writer who taught a class in San Francisco. His name was Al Hayes, and he said, "Good ad copy says, Al Hayes, your zipper is down." So, you know, I always use that when Jeffrey and I are talking, and we're talking about a show, that when we talk on the air to people, what I've observed is that people will do a show on a certain topic, and people will call and say, "I'd like to get the show about cornflakes." And, you know,
okay.
You know, so they miss the larger picture because they only heard the thing that resonated deeply to them.
Yes. So my example of that is, when I go to the doctor for my checkup and he tells me something new, which I really don't want to hear, so I hear the word, let's say the word is pain, and then I hear blah, 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 blah,
right,
from then on until I come to another word like sickness. Blah, 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 blah.
And
when I go
relief,
home and tell
yeah.
my wife what it's about and how, what I do about it, I don't have a clue.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
But this ownership idea is huge. I think, as you noticed in the book, the focus on the importance of emotion, and I don't know, maybe you had some questions about that.
Well,
subject.
I was kind of trying to drop things into the water and let the you know, let these sort of
ripples
happen.
Overlap.
But yes, my next question was about how important the process is in terms of our long-term memories and then how learning is emotional.
Yeah, the whole idea of ownership, that's how I was thinking of it right now,
yes.
It's a feeling. If you have an idea, we could say the physical thing that you have is a connection of certain neurons in your brain. And if you truly decide that it's your idea,
right.
You claim it. You claim
right.
it. You say, that's mine. And when you do that, you do it with great passion. People kill each other over their ideas when they feel strongly enough about them. And this is part of the reason why memory is it gets into the picture here, because the emotion chemicals, the things that we think of that everyone's heard of, we hear about them all the time, the serotonin or the dopamine or the noradrenaline, which
yeah.
is the same thing as
adrenaline. Catecholamines, yes, and cortisol.
And the catechols and all of those. Their very function, the thing that they do, is modify synapses in the formation of these networks in the brain that represent our knowledge. So emotion is it's sort of the modulator, if you will, of knowledge. A lot of those neurotransmitters are called modulatory in their function. They don't change the network and make it something different. They modify it as it is. And subtly mold it to become something different and new and active and emotional.
Well, now feelings, emotions turn into feelings. Feelings are your sense of things in your body.
This is what Damasio has
yes.
taught us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So. One of the things that's interesting in terms of the art of getting someone to hear what you have to say, and this is something you learn when you're in a relationship and you're arguing, is how do you manage to get the person, as you said, to understand that what you're saying is actually their idea? Because you're going to have two people saying the same thing and arguing until one of them realizes that
quite often, yeah.
yes, same thing you did. And yeah. and so there's this moment where you have to, one of you has to have enough space to realize. And in the case of a teacher and student, I think it's incumbent on, now when I say teacher, it could be anybody in a relationship where you're trying to understand what the other person, you know, get them to understand something. So then you're the teacher, that you have to focus on the person that needs to learn, by your estimation, and figure out how you can relate it to their own experience. That means that in some ways you have to shut up a little bit and listen, which is very hard to do for me.
Boy, that's tough. Yeah.
So tell us a story about that, about some of your experiences with that.
Oh, my goodness. Are you thinking of a specific story?
Well, there's many. You know, there's the one with the young man whose physical posture, he didn't even realize that he was.
Yeah.
And
okay.
then there was the
yeah.
woman with the scary story about the ducklings, which makes me sad. But
yeah, I've had a lot of reactions
you can use
to
any,
that.
Yeah, any story that you like, maybe less sad ones.
the story about my rebellious student. It was, you know, it's common for teachers get to know pretty quickly to read a lot of body language and to catch on, you know, as to whether you're getting through or not. In this particular story, the student was a freshman in a class that I was teaching, and one of these really handsome, energy-filled young men, very self-confident and very, very interested in impressing the girls in the class. And in general, I could sense he wasn't really serious about the class. And there's nothing worse for a teacher than when you see a student who it's either going over the top of their head and even worse, they don't care. So, this particular student, I got a little, I don't know, even as I think of it, I'm feeling a little embarrassed or a little ashamed of my of the way I let him get under my skin, basically, because I should know better. But I got serious, and I started, you know, talking with him and getting him in a spot where he didn't like to be. And it was strange because as I did this and he began to realize, you know, that I was asking him questions and that he was a little bit being put on the spot, his posture changed, like right in front of me almost. He was, before he was just kind of chatting and messing around in the back row, but then he leaned back in his chair and took one of those, you know, I'm your enemy or don't go near me postures, crossed his arms.
Sort of, I don't care. I don't care what you're saying.
Right.
I'm not letting any of this in kind of posture.
Right. And he was, I noticed particularly he was looking over my, he wasn't looking at me. He was looking past me over my shoulder as though I wasn't there. Well, in that situation, you know, you can't take the aggressive mode wasn't working very well. So ultimately, I don't know how I did this. I found a way to actually get him engaged a little bit. And, I know that story was the one where one of the other students said to him, Zell must be really mad at you, which, I guess I was, you know, that's probably true, but so this student began to change, and again, his body language, he didn't have to say anything, which is very often true with the human body. It kind of tells people where we're at a lot of times, mm-hmm. And so eventually he came around, and he began to get involved and actually get interested. And, you know, we were okay from then on.
Yeah, my recollection of the story is that the turning point for the young man was that he didn't even notice that he was resisting. He didn't even realize what
right.
was going on until the other person said, I think he said, you must be very angry at the professor. So, and then he suddenly he became self-conscious of what was happening, and he began to pay attention. And then he got engrossed in the material because it was interesting.
Right.
So we need to take a brief musical break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about how we learn, and I'd like to focus it back on the relevance to those of us who are concerned about taking care of ourselves, because I think that the key to leading a healthy life is beginning to be able to learn about ourselves and our environment and be effective in that way. And sometimes that's difficult for people. So, brief musical break. Your Own Health and Fitness, Lena Berman and Jeff Fawcett on the phone with James Zull, Zull, The Art of Changing the Brain. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Just don't move me the way that it should. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. There ain't no book you can read. There ain't nobody to tell you. But I don't think I'm getting what everyone's getting. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Sometimes I
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, we've got James Zull, Zull, author of The Art of Changing the Brain, on the phone with us today. If you miss parts of today's show, there's a full hour on our website, and there is also information about our guests, our book, our practice. Our archive is there, access to CD copies. There's a lot more, too, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. There's also the Facebook page for yourownhealthandfitness. And our information number is 707-874-2772. You can also email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org with everything spelled out. So one of the things that we're talking about in this particular story that you just mentioned is the need in us, and it's one of the things that makes it hard for us to let information in, is, and it's a real need, it's not a made-up need, it's not neurosis, it's real, is the need for survival and a sense of control. So when somebody resists information and deflects it, there's usually something from their past experiences that's alarming the amygdala and setting up a sort of a little bit of a fight or flight reaction. Something's getting loosened up in our past experience that's causing us. So one of the jobs of helping somebody to learn is to not resurrect old memories in a bad way, but to get them to mobilize good memories in a good way and get them cajoled or happy or make it more playful, whatever. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the idea of control is sort of there underneath everything. If we don't have control, we're scared. If we do have control,
we're scared too.
Yes, but in a different way. And sometimes people can, obviously, the struggle for control is can become probably violent at times even. It's really highly important. But the sense of our actions are driven by what we want. And control is one aspect of that, certainly. And if we sense that we're getting it, what I talk about in the book quite a bit is the idea that the brain evolved to the purpose almost of the brain is action to do things. And another element of that is behavior. The purpose of the brain is not to receive and not to just gather information and tuck it away in some corner, but it's to mold and manipulate that information in a way that will help us gain things that we want. And certainly control is one of them. I use this a lot in my teaching now. I struggle really desperately to find ways that the students can feel their how they do is related to how much control they take, and that they are free. They're not trapped. And so if you think that way, it changes your approach to teaching quite a bit. Instead of giving assignments all the time, you may let students invent their own assignments.
Exactly.
And so on, with the idea of what they're going to do, how they're going to demonstrate that they're learning. I can give them choices there. So the sense of freedom and being not being controlled really has made a difference in how I feel in the class and in how effective I am. At least that's what I believe.
Well, having a sense of agency, which is an anecdote to a sense of helplessness, and helplessness, of course, the research on animals and helplessness, which informs what we know about humans and helplessness, it's the most corrosive form of stress there is to feel trapped.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that people who seek knowledge think they're seeking information, or they think they're jumping through hoops to get something that they want at the other end, and they forget that there's a transition and a change happening to them as they learn. You hope so, anyway, and they're sort of jumping over that. You mentioned that we're in the age of information, and that's not very useful. It really should be the age of, it should be the understanding age, not the information age. It should be the understanding age. And so there's this terrible glut of information, and people are hyped up, and they're racing around, and nothing sticks. It's like you're throwing spaghetti at the wall, and nothing's sticking. It's never ready.
So
what strikes me is that by necessity, the thing that really, the switch, and it's a slow switch, I think, too, because I've known this for a while, but the switch that got thrown for me that I've been working on is that you can't cause somebody to see something or understand something or change.
What you
can do is you can give them a sense, almost a physical sense of something different, and hope that that will make it become their own, and that if you can make something become their own, so if you can either inspire them or humor them or engage their own experience, if I'm working with an individual and they say to me, I've been told that these issues, that I have these issues, the doctor says these issues, I don't want to take drugs, what can I do? Well, I'll say, okay, well, I can give you these different possible ways to do it. We can look at changing your diet. We can add in exercise. We can do these various things for you to get, you know, the equivalent of from this shore to the other shore, you know. You know, you want to cross this river, I'll tell you how to swim. I'll tell you how to row. And then people become, you know, start yes-butting. And when they start yes-butting, my challenge is to make it relevant to them. So then I have to say things like, don't think about what you're losing. Think about what you might be gaining, what you might get. And then I also have to find out what it is that they like and figure out how to mold what it is. And I even say to people, don't do this by discipline. Do it because you're feeling inspired to do it, or you're curious, that it's an experiment, that you're using your body as a laboratory. So it's,
you should come and teach my class.
Oh, I can do that if you send me money. Lots of money, yes. I can be very inspired to do that. Well, I had a remarkable experience recently where I was asked to speak at a retreat for a group of young people, young adults, who were former foster children that were now adults working with foster children. So this was a group of people who were who have had horrible early lives and have been very badly abused. And they varied in terms of their receptivity, but I think I got through to half. But the woman that hired me from the nonprofit asked me to talk about embodying, internalizing self-care. And I thought, I kind of know. But so I talked to everybody I could find that had taught these types of, you know, groups of people who, and also I'm a different generation. I'm 60 and they're, you know, 20 and 30. What they said was two things. They said, and you say this in your book, they're going to have a very strong you-know-what meter. So if you're really real with them, if you don't try to, you know, I'm trying not to use a certain expression, if you're real with them and you're authentic and you come from your own experience, then you'll get through to them. If you try to gild the lily, or you try to lie to them in some way, or you try to cajole them, they won't like it. So I really was who I am, which meant that because I'm from, you know, come from a generation where we swear a lot. So I did, and they all went, woo, you know, and then I said, I'm sorry, is that offensive? And they said, no, go girl, you know, it's fine. But the other thing was that I realized that I couldn't lecture to them, that I had to talk to them and get them to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did, is that I asked them questions, went around the rooms, and then I brought up more questions, and then I did a physical activity, which was remarkable. I had them try to sit still for 10 minutes and just listen quietly to themselves. And that was very powerful for them, because most of them couldn't do it, of course. But I said, you don't have to really do it. There's no success with this. Just notice what happens when you try. So it's very difficult to do this, because, as you say in the book, for one thing, people have selective hearing. So they don't even hear what you're saying some of the time.
Yeah, a lot of the time. I've heard that most people, when they're in a conversation, are mostly thinking about what they're going to say next. I don't know. There may be some truth in that. Well, as you were speaking, Lena, I wrote down three words.
You were thinking about what you were going to say next.
I was. Well, you brought up three ideas to me that I think are important. The first one is health. And I wanted to stress for your listeners that there's nothing better for your health than to learn something new.
Yes.
And I think a lot of us know that, but idea that, you know, as you get older, you get wiser, and you know more and more. I don't know if that's a bad metaphor maybe for aging. And what we should try to do more is learn.
Mm-hmm.
and find ways to experience change.
Mm-hmm.
Which is
inevitable.
All of which is very good brain food.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is movement. In chapter 5, I think I write about how the emotion, the pleasure centers of the brain, the reward system, which involves, among other things, the dopamine that we talked about earlier. That part of the brain is, its primary function is to organize and control our, what we do, our actions. A person with Parkinson's disease loses ability to control their voluntary movements. And that loss is because of damage to the dopamine centers in the very ancient part of the brain. So this is a very fundamental, probably a survival arrangement, certainly, at one level, and that is the idea that when we're free, when we can move and control our own motions, it's rewarding. It's intrinsic motivation, if you will. I discuss this with my students a lot, and they love to talk about intrinsic versus extrinsic rewards. And of course, that in a school context, the extrinsic reward almost always that they think of is a grade. And how you can be manipulated, you know, with a grade or with a candy bar or with some other reward, but that in itself is not fulfilling. And that your body, your brain, and your body together have gotten everything arranged so that when you are able to decide what to do and go ahead and do it and plan it and change it, and become an active mind as well as an active body, you will be happier and you will feel better. So those things are all, you might not think, you know, that that's about cognition or that the brain is this little computer up in your head that doesn't have any feelings. It's very much the opposite. The brain is actually, in evolution, the brain is an organ of emotion. The oldest brains that we know of basically are driven totally by the primitive emotion centers. And we've retained that. That's a good thing and a bad thing sometimes. But so the health, healthy mind, learn new things, freedom, and the idea of movement. With that, I use that for my students, and I keep asking them if they're getting anywhere, just to insert that metaphor of movement into their consciousness about learning is about going along a path, a direction, getting somewhere.
Well, it's both figurative and literal because movement is life, physical movement is life, and the brain and the body both benefit from physical movement, and also we are moved emotionally by things and moved by ideas. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeffrey Fawcett. We're on the phone with James Zoll, Z as in zebra, U-L-L. The book is The Art of Changing the Brain. But there's so many things that came up while you were talking. One of the issues with getting people on board with what you're saying, you know, to avoid the sort of control and survival and pushing things away. Oh, well, let me just say one thing, which is that this book really helped me because it helped me to see in a deeper way how we operate as humans, and it made it possible for me to recognize myself in your writing about the brain so that I don't feel like I'm strange or esoteric for the way that my brain works. It helped me to understand how the brain works, and it helped me to understand why it is that we get into trouble with each other when we're in close relationships. So I felt extremely liberated in a way that I don't feel by astrology and the Enneagram and other sort of constructs that type people. Because what I found in here was in the biology of the brain, there's enough explanation for why we do things that we think are perverse. In other words, it gave me an understanding of something that actually takes place for a reason in the brain that gives us a kind of, gives you a break. You know, it makes you kind of let up on yourself, because from a psychological standpoint, you know, there's learning that takes place when you examine your past and your feelings, and you begin to understand how you got where you are, and you're unwinding things. And the way the term neurotic is used is when somebody is entrenched to a point where they're habituated in behavior that no longer is relevant to the present experience. Mm. But when you study the brain, you can see how that happens on so many different levels, that there isn't something pathological about it. We're all in that place, and it really is a question of how willing somebody is to sort of move into an area of not knowing and have this experience. And so you talk about making it fun, making it relevant, telling stories to people that are not just filled with factoids, but where they get to know the big picture of what you're teaching. Instead of talking about algebra in terms of X, Y, and this and that, you talk about the unknown and the knowable and the things. And I don't understand algebra well because I didn't have a good teacher, but even teaching math, there's a story in there that's relevant to human beings.
Right.
We made it up.
That story for algebra is a story of equality.
Yes.
That's the way I am putting it in the new book. Algebra is the great story of keeping things equal and doing whatever you do to one side, you do a compensatory something or other to the other side. I just interrupted you, I think, there.
Well, it's okay. I'm interrupting myself.
You also had a number of other ideas that I might comment on.
Please.
Quickly. One thing that I have grown a lot personally is when I have begun to see myself more and more as fitting into nature's, as part of Earth. Mother Earth has taken on some new meaning. As I begin to realize a lot of the cognitive science experiments are done with chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm.
And I've come to respect the chimpanzee and actually have observed the cycle of learning that I write about in my book for human beings as exactly what goes on in a chimpanzee, the brain of a chimpanzee, and the body as he or she learns. And you just begin to realize it's a physical brain in a physical environment being changed by physical experience fitting in the world of other living things. We all belong together.
Oh, we all operate with the same kinds of ripples that, like we said before, you know, so I drop something into the water and there are these ripples. There's this action that occurs and it affects everything around you.
Right, right.
Including other people.
Yeah.
In a big way. So I remember one friend of mine was upset with me because she didn't think I was listening. And I was listening, but what she said to me was provocative and it triggered me. So
yeah.
I was upset. And she said, well, I have to be able to express myself. And later when I was quiet and I had a chance to think about it, I realized that you can express yourself. You just have to be willing to take the consequences. So sometimes it's better to just feel what you're feeling,
to be
listen
careful
to it
what
yourself.
You say
yeah, because
interviews.
There's it's going to have. Well, I Lena, you're an idiot. No. So yeah, the argument stuff is very tricky because emotion trumps learning. So you have to whatever you can do. In fact, you talk also about the fact that learning is about using these things, you know, actually get movement
action.
In action and movement and doing it, learning.
Yeah.
So if it's
the
about
the new book starts that way.
I can't wait.
It starts with the great transformation, I call it. It's the conversion of perception into action.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing thing when you think of it, how you can perceive something and then you want to do it. And our instinct to copy and to mimic
yes.
and all of that.
Yes, yes. But it's also, you say, and I agree, that change is about use and it's also physical and it takes some time to integrate it and some reflection. And that's the part that's been really interesting for me because I'm kind of a fast person. My brain works quickly.
I can see that.
Yeah, but I do hear things, and then I do take, I make time, I purposely make time, I meditate, I do, you know, to have some solitude and some quiet so that I can integrate some of this stuff.
Right. Well, you were talking about arguing a few times.
Yes.
To me, arguing is more evidence that we love our ideas.
Very much so.
Because our arguments mostly are about, you know, what we believe and think. And we're willing to, you know, be pretty abusive with other people if they don't give us our ideas. And anyway.
So how do you understand when two people are in that place? What would be the thing that would? I mean, the thing that occurs to me after your book really had a profound effect. I just want to be very clear to the listeners that this book for me was transformational and very impactful. Now it may be about me, but Jeffrey found it so
I think, it's not everybody feels
I love this book. So I know so I'm thinking
no, thank you very much
no you're
that.
Very welcome. I'm
thank
so grateful for the work. It's really 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 well written and it draws you right in. I mean, it's up until midnight reading it, so so I think that the next time I'm in an argument, if I can slow myself down enough and say, okay, here we are in this familiar situation. So maybe the answer from what we've learned from your book is to pause for a moment and think about the fact that, as you said, you're arguing because you're in love with your ideas, or I'm in love with my ideas, and that what I need to do in that moment is think about what the other person is doing or needs,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which is very hard to do because you're annoyed.
That's hard, yeah. But and the thing that makes it hard is that probably most people aren't doing it. So you hate to feel so alone.
Yeah. Yep. Oh my. How has this work changed your relationships?
I don't know. I got to be just. I tell you one thing. That's a hard question to answer, but
no, it's okay.
I have discovered that I know a lot of things
mm-hmm.
that I didn't realize I knew. And a lot of the writing in the book and in the second book, it's sort of like Plato said. Plato believed that our knowledge was all, I believe this. I haven't read Plato, okay? But I've been told this, that our knowledge is within us and our job is to get it out.
Yes.
And I've come to take on that. It's just that the knowledge, the form of the knowledge is somewhat different than what Plato imagined. But to discover what I know, by writing has changed me a lot. A lot of times it's when I'm upset about something or when I'm anxious and so on, I've gotten in this thing of I start writing more on chapter 8 or something. And right away, my whole mind changes, my emotional state, everything. It might be an hour or two go by, and I hardly know it.
Mm-hmm.
Just by the process of self-discovery.
Mm-hmm.
One of my friends recently told me that, I haven't seen this work, but that the eye perceives, I don't know what the number was, but maybe 100 times or 1,000 times more information than it can process,
mm-hmm.
than the visual cortex can process. So only a small amount of what we perceive actually gets into the conscious images in our brain. And so there is a lot of stuff in there that you didn't even know when it got there, probably. But it makes, again, it's a physical metaphor and a physical image of gaining knowledge subconsciously and discovering it by accident. So that's been fun.
Well, if as you say, which I feel and felt very powerfully when I was reading your book, that when we learn, the information or the ideas are actually playing notes inside of us. They're resonating. Mm-hmm. They're notes that are already in there for us to be, for it to be played again. So it'd be played on. It's as if your words are playing a piano inside us and it's making this music. And then we hear it. That sense of discovery is a sense of discovery of who we really are in a deep level and having it sort of be discovered by ourselves. In really good learning, but it requires, I believe, some quietude, as you said, and that may be the challenge of this age of.
Did I say that?
Yeah, you did, and I agree with you.
Okay, I've stressed that in the new book.
Yeah,
there's a lot of emphasis on groups in class and how learning is better when people work together and so on, and I don't disagree with that overall, but I believe there's almost essential need for when a person is really serious about wanting to understand something or be, you know, be more in depth than,
yes.
than what we
yes.
feel we might be. That's kind of solitary.
Yeah, it requires some quiet.
Yeah.
I am so out of time. I'm so sorry. But we'll have you back when we get your new book.
Well, okay, it'll be a while. But
that's all right. We can wait.
I look forward to it.
Yeah, we can wait. So,
thank
James
you.
Zoll, thank you very much. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, our practice, our archive of 600 shows, access to CD copies, and there's lots more too at yourownhealthandfitness.org. We also have two Facebook pages, one for Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and another for the show Your Own Health and Fitness. Our information number is 707-874-2772, and you can email us at admin, admin, at yourownhealthandfitness.org, with all of it spelled out, including and. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Jeff Fawcett, PhD. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.